Mr. Shepard, floor is yours.
Good morning, and may it please the court. In its orders below, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission interpreted the reliability exception to ISO New England's proration rule to mean that resources in the state of Connecticut, where undeniably capacity is most needed in New England, must be paid less than any other resource in the New England system, despite the undisputed fact that those resources are absolutely essential to preserve the reliability of the grid. We argued below that FERC's interpretation violates the Federal Power Act's prohibition against undue discrimination, and that it furthermore contradicts the core purposes of the forward capacity market.
The reason for that is to ensure that the total payment cap's not exceeded, correct?
No, Your Honor, the purpose of the capacity market
is... Now, of why you said at a lower price, right, isn't the overall objective to ensure that the total payment cap's not exceeded?
I'm focusing on a different overall objective. Sir, Judge Kavanaugh, the overall objective I'm referring to here is our core purpose argument below, the one that FERC did not respond to, which, as the Commission and this Court, in numerous panels in which Judge Garland has participated, has recognized, is to incentivize the retention or construction of capacity resources when, and most particularly where, they are most needed. Right. So that is intimately tied to our undue discrimination claim under the statute. It is not disputed that the effect of FERC's orders here is to cause my client's resources to be paid less for every unit of capacity than every other resource on the system, despite the fact that it is completely undisputed that they are utterly essential to keep the lights on in New England. That is not an argument that FERC chose to respond to in its order on rehearing. And FERC very ably and accurately described exactly what our arguments were, for example, in paragraph 38 of its rehearing order. They just chose not to respond to either of those arguments at all. Instead, less than a month later, FERC accepted for filing a tariff clarification filed by ISO New England that was designed expressly to reverse the outcome of the initial order and was pending before the Commission before it even acted on rehearing. When it accepted that revision, it expressly...
I wasn't sure you raised this on rehearing.
Oh, we did, Your Honor.
Citing the FPA?
I'm sorry? Citing the FPA?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the joint appendix, we're looking for the specifications of error in the request for rehearing and then several pages of the order below. The rehearing request starts at the joint appendix on page 102.
Mm-hmm. The specifications... Judge Kavanaugh's question is, you make the argument... Do you tie it specifically to the FPA?
Ah, yes, Your Honor.
Where is that?
If we go to the heading, for example, on JA-110, this is subheading C of the request for rehearing, interpretation of the April 20, 2008 order, if allowed, result in undue discrimination?
Right, but so I guess, again, the question is, there's two ways to think about this. One way is that this is a sort of a fairness argument that should be addressed. Unfair causes undue discrimination. But the other way to think about it is that it is specifically an FPA argument and that they violated the FPA by not doing that. That might be a different argument. But I don't see, I think, and Judge Kavanaugh is asking, I also don't see an actual FPA site.
So your worry is that, well, Your Honor,
you don't necessarily lose by not having it, but you might lose your FPA argument.
I'm glad that you asked the question. I don't believe that in this context there could be any misunderstanding about what was meant by undue discrimination. That has a very precise meaning that FERC is very familiar with. I do see that in the discussion that I'm looking at here, no cite to 16 U.S.C. 824 D or E. That'd be section 205 and 206 of the Federal Power Act. But I don't think there can be any doubt that that's what we're talking about here. The standard, although it's an excursion from FERC's orders because, as I mentioned, they did not ever discuss either of these claims below, is that if you have resources that are similarly situated or customers that are similarly situated, they either pay or are paid the same amount for providing the same sorts of services. Here we have a corollary to that rule, which is where you're providing superior services, you should not, in fact, be paid less.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think your brief argues that simply as a matter of language, this provision with many numbers compels your reading. And you certainly argue that any reading other than your reading is unreasonable. Insofar as you're making the first argument, I'm not sure that I follow it.
Your Honor, I think if I can try to capture what your question is, I believe what you're saying is, are we still making a Chevron Step 1 argument that the plain meaning of the tariff dictates?
Yeah, that's putting it into the jargon. That's
That is an argument that is perhaps more palatable to inveterate FERC lawyers, and particularly those who have been toiling in the fields of ISO New England's capacity market for years and years, because we were in the room when the sausage was being cut, and we know what we meant when we wrote the words. But I am perfectly happy to contest this case on reasonableness grounds. My view is something like this, Your Honor. Where the number of reasons you can stack up for why FERC's interpretation is unreasonable gets this high, it eventually becomes clear that there has to be a plain meaning problem.
I understand. Okay. Can we turn to your argument by analogy to 313.25.25, the delisting treatment?
The bids rejected for liability reasons?
Right.
Yes, Your Honor. And that the reason why we bring that up is because in the eight words that we're concerned with here from the textual standpoint, this is of course distinct from our argument. We have any proration as our subject, and we believe that applies to the entire. It is an exception that was born of the eradication of everything in front of it. That is what exceptions do when you posit them last, and when you put them last in place and last in time. That's what we think the rational result is. But we have the back half, which is subject to reliability review. Subject to reliability review is a phrase that appears several places in the forward capacity market rules. Those are set forth in, testing my memory here, note 14, approximately page 47 of our brief. They relate to things like dynamic delist bids and a bunch of other gobbledygook.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm just talking about the meaning of 13.25.25.
The reliability exception?
Yeah, okay. which brings in just and reasonable rates. And I guess you say that argues, there are two arguments. One is it makes the commission inconsistent when it says that, or at least possibly inconsistent, when it says that the total payment price is an absolute ceiling that cannot be breached. It also is a slightly different argument, inconsistent with the proposition that when you're not allowed to prorate quantity, it follows ineluctably that you get the clearing price for the non-reduced quantity. And I'm just the allusion to just and reasonable rates is, I'm not sure how that fits exactly.
I understand where you're getting just and reasonable rates from. Are you talking about the provision that is specifically set aside for bids rejected for liability purposes? Or are we talking about the eight words that are in doubt here about any reliability shall be proration shall be subject to reliability review?
Here we are. On page 48 of your brief, the footnote there, which quotes part B of 13.25.25.
Okay. I think now I understand. So this is the rule that is expressly set aside for bids rejected for liability
right.
reasons.
Right. Right.
That is an out-of-market process. Basically, if you make a bid or take one of the actions that are described there, and that causes an unacceptable result for the reliability of the grid, then you go into an out-of-market process. And if Your Honor wants to get an exhaustive treatment of this, instead of focusing on the one paragraph in the initial order and the three paragraphs in the rehearing order devoted to our issue, Your Honor could instead look at the vast majority of ink spilled in the first part of both the initial order and the rehearing order, which is about the dynamic delist bid that was submitted by NRG. They chose to bail out as the descending clock was falling. Uh-huh. There was no doubt that they were going to break the cap by doing so. So what happens in that instance is they go to an out-of-market, it was understood to be a cost-based rate where they're going to give you a fair, just and reasonable
rate
determined based on your value to the grid. And that's one method.
Sorry, based on your value to the grid. Because I mean, garden variety just and reasonable is just historic cost.
Yes, that's why people expect that you would at least get back your cost to the extent they're attributable to making sure that the grid is going to run.
But what you're saying is in this context, it's not it's driven in part by the demand side.
Your Honor, it puts me in an awkward position to try to sculpt how a just and reasonable rate was going to be derived in this out-of-market setting. NRG's particular rate, that never occurred with, and I agree that there is no detailed mechanism for how this is going to be set, except we know that it's going to be set out of market and beside rather than above or beyond the cap. It's a separate proceeding.
Your basic argument is that one can infer from this section that the drafters of the tariff anticipate conditions where the total payment cap will be breached.
Indeed, I think that the total payment cap is just a Swiss cheese. There are a lot of different ways gets evaded. So, Your Honor, it was never as sacrosanct as FERC pretends. And moreover, as we point out in our reply brief, not only is it not a sacrosanct objective, it's not one that even comes close to being breached. There's still $18.2 million unspent beneath the cap because ISO New England miscalculated the amount of capacity available from Canada. So we're sitting here still on direct review in a 205 case, and we know that the animating principle of FERC's entire order, thou shalt not bust the cap, isn't going to happen. And the year is over, so all the payments have been made. We know that the money is there, and the payment cap was never reached.
Let me ask you another question in response to this whole business about the payment cap. If ISO New England has to take more from Connecticut than a quantity proration would produce and pay the higher price of the two that it was talking about, why can't the cap problem be solved by reducing quantities of the others, the non-Connecticut suppliers?
Your Honor, I believe you've just entered my rebuttal.
My colleagues will let you answer.
No, that's the perfect. I'm very happy to answer that question. I think, you know, Your Honor, I forgot what it was. When the light
well,
snapped on my brain.
Alternative ways of satisfying,
yes.
Assuming it's an absolute.
I think there are at least two, Your Honor.
Okay.
One of them would be what we argued initially, which was to say you should put us in the rules, the bids rejected for liability rule, and treat us as an out-of-market solution. That's one method. The other method.
That means at least potentially breaching.
That will certainly breach the cap.
Okay.
That will definitely do it.
Okay.
Another way of doing it and remaining inside the cap would be, for example, to do it in a stair-stepped way and say, you guys are needed for reliability. You get the floor price. First, we pay you the floor price, and then we pay everyone else less. But, Your Honor, we know what the correct outcome is because the correct outcome was adopted in April of 2010 in the FCM revisions order. They explain
I understand that, but I just wanted to make clear that you are contending, at least now, I don't think you were in your brief, that there were ways apart from the solution adopted in 2010 by which the total payment cap could be preserved, given a full effect, and payment to you given full effect. At the higher
yes,
rate,
Your Honor,
given full effect.
FERC has at its disposal
arithmetically,
a large
number
of tools. We're in a 205 case.
Yeah.
Whenever we're in a 205 case, we have the opportunity to, while it's still on review and hasn't been yet finally disposed of, to come up with all sorts of ways of solving the problem, which is one of the reasons why we were so knocked aback by FERC's suggestion on brief that somehow the undue discrimination argument was subsumed within the interpretive arguments that FERC did choose to respond to. We know that's not true. The Commission routinely and this Court routinely deals with undue discrimination claims where there is utter agreement about exactly what the contract means or what the tariff means, and yet the party who is aggrieved comes before this Court or goes before FERC and says, we all agree about what this means. It violates the statute. So there's no.
Usually the statute's cited, though.
Indeed, Your Honor. I apologize for that violation. I do not think, or I guess not a violation. It is definitely an oversight.
It seems to me you still have the argument that even if that were the case with respect to the statute, I understand your argument about the context in which the words are said, that if this is a Chevron Step 2 case, in interpreting you're asking them to take into consideration the issue of undue discrimination and also to take into consideration the locational pricing issue. In fact, the way you describe the locational pricing issue is you say, that one says the interpretation is inconsistent with the fundamental policy goals of FCM.
That's right. That was definitely the most important way it was broached in the initial protest, which unfortunately was hampered by the fact, and Your Honor, I am now 26 minutes or 26 over my time.
You actually are 29 over. I've got a little clock right here.
I don't want to abuse my privilege of speaking to you. The initial protest was hampered by the fact that it took ICE New England an incredibly long time to actually conduct its proration review to figure out whether or not the reliability system was going to work out properly. So the protest was filed when this was only a glimmer as a possibility that something might happen, and my client's approach was to say, surely whatever it is you're going to do, you're not going to pay us less if you're telling us now that our resources are more valuable. And then we get the initial order, now adopting the interpretation that we object to, and then we're statutorily required to file for rehearing all many, many months in advance of even finding out what the results of the reliability review were going to be, which is why when there was that later compliance filing, there's yet another protest.
Now you're reading into rebuttal time, which we might give you. so of your hypothetical rebuttal time, you probably want to save as much of that as possible.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. We'll hear from the opposing side.
May it please the Court, Jennifer Amerkel for the Commission. I want to start first with Judge Williams' questions about the total payment cap. We do not believe that the total payment cap is just Swiss cheese. Section 13.2.5.2.5 provides for out-of-market payments. That's what the just and reasonableness provision refers to there. If you look at...
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Was that the... I thought you threw in an extra number. I was talking about 13.2525.
Yes.
Indeed.
Actually, the provision I'm going to point you towards is at JA 188.
That's a different one.
And this is the provision that... that provides what the just and reasonable compensation for D-list bids, those bids that want to exit the market that aren't participating in the auction, what they get paid. And they get paid their bid. This is section 13.2.5.2.5.1.
Is it AI or AA?
Yeah, right.
It's AI, which... about the middle of that provision, it says D-list bid has been rejected for liability reasons, and then about five lines below that, payment shall be made on the basis of its D-list bid. And then at the end of that AI section, it says the commission's going to review it to make sure that the bid is the just and reasonable rate.
Oh, I'm sorry, the D-list bid.
And this is a bit off subject because these are out-of-market payments. In the total payment cap, that is about what is paid for through the auction, not out of market. And the bids in, when a supplier wants to voluntarily participate in the auction and it gets a supply obligation through that auction, it is paid the auction price, subject to the total payment cap. And just like other provisions of the same tariff, and I'm specifically referring to the bilateral transfer of obligations and the reconfiguration auctions. Once a capacity supplier commits to that obligation in the auction, it can't shed that obligation, and it doesn't get any extra compensation for not being able to shed that obligation. It can't participate in the reconfiguration
auctions.
That's
your conclusion, right?
That's what's required in the tariff, Your Honor.
You're under your interpretation of the tariff. right? We're arguing about the interpretation.
The commission has also interpreted those provisions of the tariff.
I understand. That's in the issue in the order before us, right?
Actually, no. This is in the joint appendix at 371 through 372, where the commission said it's not unduly discriminatory once a supplier accepts a capacity supply obligation to limit that supplier's flexibility to shed the obligation.
That's not what they said in the order about this before us now.
That's right? Correct, Your Honor.
So that's what I want to ask you about. If you were sitting here for the previous argument, basically the same questions, which is somebody raised, in this case, PSEG, a particular attack on the agency's interpretation. They specifically said that it would, if allowed, it would result in undue discrimination, and they also said it would be inconsistent with the policy of recognizing locational value of capacity. I don't see an answer. And there's no doubt that FERC understood they were raising those because FERC recited that they had raised those, but FERC doesn't respond at all. What do you say about that?
The FERC thought that the commission thought that those two arguments, actually it did respond to what it thought the goal of these provisions were.
Well, it said what it said the goal was without discussing these other two problems at all.
Yes, and in part the discussion about the goal was a commission directive of many different directives. There's nothing in either the settlement that created the market rules or in the market rules themselves that state that the goal of the market rules is to provide locational compensation to capacity resources. In fact,
that's
the,
what you say.
Think it's consistent with FERC policy to give a lower price to the most needed resources as a general matter?
That's actually what I'm policy. Saying is here that's not what happened. The commission didn't give a lower price to those capacity resources that were most needed. Every megawatt of capacity that cleared in the auction received the same price. Then that was the $4.25. If you voluntarily entered into the auction, you got a capacity supply obligation, you were paid $4.25 for each megawatt. Then there's an optionality, a flexibility for the suppliers to shed those obligations and to effectively create a higher price. But everyone in the market was paid the same amount for each megawatt.
But if they and didn't, their total they didn't want to stay in, if they didn't want that price, they could get out, everybody but these guys.
Right, but that creates discrimination about their flexibility, which the commission has addressed in other orders.
Well, but this is an interesting argument, but you agree it's not the argument that FERC made in there. They didn't say anything about either of these points.
No, I think that FERC did make this argument about it's the supplier's flexibility, not the price, because it was saying the flexibility to prorate your quantities. This is at in the rehearing order, paragraphs 40 and 42, JA 154. It found that reliability didn't trump this flexibility.
Wait, I'm looking at paragraph 40 and 42. I'm not saying what you're saying. Maybe I just don't understand FERC's words, but
In 40, the commission said the flexibility to megawatt prorate.
Were you talking about the rehearing order?
Yep.
Paragraph 40 begins, the commission rejects PSEG's request.
Mm-hmm. The second sentence says that suppliers...
I don't see the word flexibility in there. Am I missing that? It says that suppliers...
They may elect this optionality, the flexibility. That's what I'm talking about. The option to choose megawatt proration instead of price proration. So... the commission is saying in that paragraph that reliability is paramount and that we're not going to allow it to trump the optionality in the tariff provision.
Sorry, all they're saying is we reject PSEG's argument. They described PSEG's argument, said we reject it. That's not a reason. That's the conclusion.
Well, they restate.
And if you look at 42, mm-hmm. The ISO New England is complying with section Roman numeral 3-13.2.7.3 to the extent that is prohibiting quantity proration to maintain reliability.
No, I understand that. That's just a restatement of the conclusion. They say we agree with ISO New England's interpretation. They don't say why. Let me ask you another question. You argue in your brief that this is ambiguous, that the section at issue is ambiguous, correct?
Yes.
But and that means we're in Chevron 2, correct?
Yes.
But I don't read the commission as saying that. That is, the commission says in its first order at paragraph 75, the FCM rules are clear that such resources will only be allowed to prorate the price they receive and not their megawatt capacity obligation. And at, I'm just trying to find the other, at JA-154 at paragraph 41, they say the current tariff language does not allow ISO New England to meet these requirements. That sounds like a Chevron 1 argument, that is, that it's clear on its face. We certainly have cases saying that if the agency thinks it's clear and we think it's ambiguous, and here even agency counsel think it's ambiguous, we need to send it back so that the agency can apply its discretion and decide what's reasonable when it realizes it's not required by the language. Isn't that right? Why doesn't that apply?
That's the correct understanding of Chevron, but yeah. That's not what's happening here.
Why not? Yeah.
I think what the commission is saying in paragraph 75 of the compliance order is that in these circumstances, it's clear that it's not going to allow reliability to trump this optionality in the tariff. That in these circumstances, reliability has to win. And then I'll point you to that.
I don't understand how that advances the ball at all. I mean, there's nothing I understand PSEG to be saying that undermines reliability.
Oh, to the contrary, Your Honor. In their rehearing request, and I believe they're also in their first protest, they were talking about how the rights of capacity suppliers to choose this option, to exercise their flexibility, is absolute. And it's their choice is over what ISO New England gets to do. The remedy that they were requesting is something very different from that. But they were making the argument that, and in fact, it's in the orders that they were making that argument, and that's what the commission was responding to, that their rights are absolute to choose to reduce their megawatts. I believe it's in the rehearing order.
I'm just looking at the rehearing order. Page 154 of the joint appendix, the second column, under the current rule, when the clearing price reaches 6 times cone, the liability does not lack quantity proration, the ISA must engage in price proration to avoid violating its tariff requirement, and so forth. So, I mean, it seems to base it not on any jeopardy for reliability, but a purported jeopardy to the payment cap.
They also say in their rehearing request at JA-103, in their April 17, 2008 protest, the PSEG companies contended that if the Connecticut units were prevented from prorating due to their reliability review, they should be paid the full unprorated clearing price.
Right, that's talking about their remedy that they're seeking.
Yeah.
But their interpretation of the tariff is they have an absolute right to exercise that flexibility. And in fact, in their rehearing request, they talk about the flexibility. They use that term flexibility, and that they have an absolute right.
So then I can understand what you're saying, which is that the commission is saying, oh, you can't just withdraw your resources. But what's their answer to the price issue? What's the answer to the idea that the tariff is ambiguous and
okay.
should permit?
Sure. Just 1 second. The argument that it's absolute is in paragraph 37 of the rehearing order J-153. Regarding the whether it's ambiguous or not, I'll point you to on the same page where the commission said it's clear in these circumstances that we're not going to let reliability, we're not going to let flexibility trump reliability. That the commission interpreted what it thought was the ambiguous language, which is that any prorations shall be subject to reliability review sentence. And that's in footnote 78. Yes, it is in 78. JA 100. So in this footnote, the commission starts with saying, here's the ambiguous sentence. Any proration shall be subject to reliability review. We interpret this sentence. So it's recognizing that it is interpreting an ambiguous sentence. And it's really hard to look at that sentence and not think that it's ambiguous. It doesn't even say who is going to do the reliability review, when it's going to happen, and what impact.
It doesn't really say it's ambiguous.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, the process of interpretation encompasses, if we want to be in Chevron language, prongs one and two. It does.
Well, the commission thought it was interpreting this language.
I think what Judge Williams said, you can interpret language by two methods. One, you could say it's clear, and that's how we interpret it, or two, you can say it's ambiguous, and this is how we interpret it. But is your argument that the question of remedy is not a interpretation of the tariff question, but only a remedy question, so that there's nothing at all, that the only argument they could be making about the tariff is that they'd be allowed to withdraw capacity, and that's bad because that would damage reliability, and that there's nothing in the tariff that provides this remedy? Is it, when you're telling me that this is an interpretation of the tariff, is that also an interpretation of the tariff with respect to remedy?
Yes, and I think there are many different interpretations of this tariff, and you could find several different remedies in the tariff, but the way that the commission interpreted it is that there's flexibility denied to the suppliers when they want to shed a capacity supply obligation, and that cannot trump the reliability.
There are many different ways we can exceed the total payment cap.
That's correct. The objective
is... Okay, so that's the one absolute under which you can choose a couple, I don't know about many, but a few different routes so long as you stay under that cap, right?
Yes.
So what, I guess one would be that other people have to get paid less rather than the people who's...
Judge Williams was suggesting, we could do refunds on the other generators and make them pay back money that they were paid so that the total payment cap is...
Is there a response about that, that they didn't ask for that, or that why wasn't that a possibility here then?
I believe that the commission only thought they were asking for out-of-market, an out-of-market remedy because of the comparison with the D-list bids.
If you stick with the total payment cap and the reliability concern requires them not to quantity prorate, then the only way to stick with the total payment cap.
Well, that's certainly what the commission thought, but there are other reasonable interpretations.
Price proration, right? Unless you do what Judge Williams and Judge Garland were just discussing about taking money back from others, right?
Or you can do what the 2010 revisions did and override the total payment cap.
Right. Well, that's right. But my premise of these questions was that the total payment cap is an absolute, at least in the commission's interpretation of the language, and actually does seem to be in there, that the total payment cap's important. So you have to stay within that, and that limits your options then if you're going to have a reasonable reading of this thing.
Yes.
Can we just go back to what actually you started out with, and that is, what is it about the passage you called our attention to that explains why the consequences of a reliability override on a delisting must be treated completely differently from the reliability override in the auction, or I guess after the auction has produced something. I mean, that appears to be the assertion in paragraph 41, but I'm not sure. I haven't seen anything that makes that either self-evident or as a policy matter compelling or particularly good idea.
Well, I believe that the Commission completely understood the difference between a D-list bid, which is paid.
That's a different question.
It may have understood, but has it explained to anybody why there's such a radical difference in treatment?
Yes, because the D-list bid is covered by different provisions. That's paragraph 41.
Everybody understands it's covered by a different provision. The question is why there should be what appears to be a different outcome under one set of words than under another, granted, as now is universally accepted, that this provision is ambiguous.
So you're asking why there should be a different outcome between the D-list bids that are seeking to exit the market and they are involuntarily kept in the market and paid an out-of-market price,
right,
and between those that fully agree that they're going to abide by the rules and participate in the...
Given that the rules are ambiguous. Make sure you incorporate that,
yes, proposition. Yes, the rules that are ambiguous,
yeah,
that if you think they're ambiguous and you don't know for sure what they mean...
Well, that goes to your... they have lost it by failing to protest when the original thing was filed, but it doesn't sound from the argument here as if you've won on that. So could you go on assuming you haven't won on that?
So
maybe you have. I don't know what my colleagues think, but they haven't spent much time on that.
I think the Commission recognized that there's an inequity here, that it doesn't on its face make a lot of sense.
And there was an ambiguity.
And an ambiguity, yes.
By which it could resolve that inequity.
But it looked at the tariff and it didn't see a way to resolve that.
You're really making the case fit very perfectly into NLRB versus Prill, the case that Judge Garland was alluding to, where the agency thinks it's absolutely in a straitjacket and therefore doesn't use its mind to address the problem.
The Commission didn't think it was in a straitjacket. It thought that these inequities would be resolved in the proceeding that was before it.
Why not resolve it in this case as well? Because as Judge Williams is saying, if reliability is a concern here that can override, why not in the out-of-market as well when they in the delisting process?
Because there were specific...
So reliability, if you do it in the delisting process, reliability, tough. Here, though, if you're in the auction and reliability is concerned, you can be forced to stay in. And I think if I have that right, what sense does that make? And you're calling it an inequity and you're calling it ambiguous. So...
Well, it was...
That's a long way... I mean, that's very close to saying it's unreasonable at step two.
This is not in the Commission orders, but in the joint appendix, it does say that once you accept... The Commission has said that once you accept a capacity supply obligation, you have to keep that supply obligation.
That's also a restatement of the conclusion. It's actually a restatement of a different conclusion, but it doesn't seem to respond to the...
And the Commission also said it's not unduly discriminatory to not pay those suppliers that have accepted a capacity supply obligation. It's not unduly discriminatory to not give them extra compensation because they...
Going towards this argument that, well, we have a specific rule about one thing. We don't have it about the other. One implication could be they negotiated one and they didn't negotiate the other.
Yes, I think that could...
I mean, the fact that there is another entire process listed for what to do under one circumstance, and that process is not listed for what to do under this circumstance.
This is where I'm not conveying the information. The tariff has...
A very charitable way of putting our inability to...
The tariff has several different provisions for what to do when a resource is needed for after the reliability review. Mm-hmm. One of those is the D list.
Is this in the auction? Oh, no, it's not in the auction. Okay.
No. One of them is in the D list. That's for involuntary participation and get out of market. Then there are provisions for who can, when you have accepted a supply obligation, who can participate in the reconfiguration auctions. And when you have accepted an obligation, whether you can transfer that obligation to another through a bilateral contract. Those two provisions have reliability review in them, just like the D-list bid does. And in fact, they point back to the same 13.2.5.2.5 as the type of reliability review that is required. But they don't give any extra compensation. And they do reduce the obligation, they reduce the flexibility or the optionality to shed your capacity supply obligation. So the tariff really has two different tracks for treating the reliability review. If you've accepted an obligation, you can't shed it if you're needed for reliability. You don't get any extra compensation. If you don't want to participate in the auction, but we're making you because of reliability needs, then we're going to pay you an out-of-market. Okay. Now, that's not in the orders, Your Honor.
It's all right. We're the ones who raised the issue, I think, so it's all right for you to try to answer it. Any more questions for counsel? All right, well, to your opposing counsel, since we gave FERC counsel considerable extra time, we'll give you some extra time to rebut. That's 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First item that was mentioned by FERC's counsel was that there is not some difference in the amount of payment that capacity resources are paid. That is false. Everyone else in the system who decided to prorate their megawatt quantity gets paid $450. My client gets paid $425.
Can I ask you about a conversation I was having with FERC counsel, which is there a difference between reducing and therefore damaging reliability and the remedy? So as I understand the FERC argument with respect to the tariff provision, any proration shall be subject to reliability review. They believe that means, and leave aside the word clearly or not, that you just can't reduce capacity because that would damage reliability.
We absolutely agree with that.
You do absolutely agree with it.
Absolutely.
So where
that is why we were more than a little upset to see in the rehearing order this straw man argument put out at the beginning of the rehearing that you're essentially arguing that you get to pull your quantity and tank reliability for the region. That was never our position. Absolutely never our position.
You want to exceed the total payment cap because you want to get the price for the additional capacity, and that will blow the total payment cap, which is a key part of this whole deal, at least so FERC says.
That's correct, Your Honor. With the exception I'm not agreeing with FERC's representation, but our position is that our position from the outset of this case was that if your intent is going to be to force us to keep all of our megawatts in, then you can't give us a lower price. We don't think that's the correct way to interpret the language, and even if it were the correct way to interpret the language, and everybody agreed that was its plain meaning, you violate the statute, need to change it in this 205 proceeding before we move forward.
Because it's discrimination.
Exactly. Yeah. That was clearly the remedy they wanted. To the extent
that the better interpretation of this is that the total payment cap stands, and you've participated in the auction, and therefore you know it's a possibility that this is going to happen. You might be forced into price proration.
Your Honor, they describe this as the specificity principle, the specific purpose of this particular provision,
right.
The proration rule writ large, not the reliability exception at the end, mm-hmm. is to create this price cap. We agree. That's exactly what this provision was created for. We also observe that it was amended after it was initially drafted to include this language, and that there has to be a purpose to the amendment, and that it could not be the case that this was somehow some sub silentio amendment that erased the flexibility of generators to decide whether or not they were going to prorate one or the other. It doesn't mean that anyone is contemplating trying to destroy the reliability of the system. It's just saying, if you're going to do this, you're going to take away the optionality on the quantity reduction. You can't take away the optionality on the price. Put us into an out-of-market solution or find some other solution if you're saying that this is what you really meant by this. But the commission called this a small tweak when it was accepted the first time. It didn't even merit in the list of 8 or 9 things that they were talking about having happened during that housekeeping order. They never even mentioned that that's what it was. And so everyone, I think, in the entire market was surprised when we got this particular result here, which is why it seemed appropriate. Particularly,
then you made a policy argument that this was unfair, and FERC changed it, right?
It did. It went back to the stakeholder process.
Right. And the question is whether it was unreasonable prior to the change for FERC to read this language and the overall purposes of the price cap and do it in the way. And at that level of that question, was it unreasonable, we're pretty deferential.
Indeed, Your Honor, except for when FERC entirely fails to respond to the argument. You're focusing on the word unreasonable. The three-prong test in the
right,
statute
okay.
is
so that goes back to what you started with today, the undue discrimination.
It's unduly discriminatory. It
and
is.
Whether that's a separate, whether that's a way to interpret this language more flexibly or different, or whether that's a whole freestanding separate argument.
Well,
and your specifications of error at the beginning of the rehearing request, it didn't list, you know, the commission violated FPA 205 by.
I think you've done a good job of illustrating that folks should be better about citing the statute they're talking about instead of
That's
referring
one
to
of
the statutory
my hobby horses. Yeah.
No, I appreciate that. There is another point I think that's been lost in this process, Your Honor, and it's this. We keep referring to a capacity obligation. And that is an obligation that everybody who's a generator takes seriously, not only because they want to serve the public properly, but also because that obligation comes with lots of other things attached, like penalties. So when you tell someone you're not going to let them relieve themselves of the obligation for any megawatt, not a single one, you are seriously impinging on their operational flexibility. If they fail to deliver that capacity, they're subject to penalties and a wide variety of other bad things that happen, quite apart from the price. So there are... I'm struggling very hard to think of any reason why a commercial supplier would ever choose to go with not reducing its megawatts, and therefore you'd have to have a price solution. And with that,
further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ron.
We'll take the matter under consideration.
Let's send back a check.